Hi, it's Tony here. Join me every Friday, 3 till 5 p.m. for Getting Bristol Home, up-to-date traffic and travel, great music, local interviews, and the stars who are appearing across the area.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
It is a move against truth. It is a move against meaning and a move against certainty. There's no such thing as truth. You cannot find meaning in life. You've got to manufacture it yourself, and you can't be certain about anything. But they obviously are certain about no meaning and certain about no truth. So they bring in that certainty to suit themselves. Now, there's no truth, no meaning, no certainty. There's another aspect to this. They take away from the author the prerogative of fusing words with his or her own meaning. So if you write a book, the postmodernists will read it and deconstruct it to reinterpret what they think you ought to have said or what they want to make you say.
I believe you and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee.
And the message that I am bringing you is clear. It is concise, and there can be no mistake in its interpretation. You must wake up now or be enslaved. The war has begun many years ago. The war was declared by our enemies upon us. You had better listen.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is the future of the RAF really a $150 million apiece US jet that's not up to frontline service? No wonder they call it the Lockheed F-35 the scam jet. Around the time of last year's Strategic Defence Review, Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne revealed he'd be buying an extra 100 F-35B Lightning jets for the RAF and Royal Navy specifically to equip Britain's new aircraft carriers. Soon after, the US Congress revealed they would be cutting back severely on their orders for the F-35 because of spiralling costs and lack of reliability, cracks appearing in the wings, and a lack of manoeuvrability, raising serious questions over whether Lockheed's state-of-the-art jet was even up to the job. With costs put at between £80 and £200 million for each F-35, meaning a programme cost of around £20 billion, is it time to open the air brakes on the scamjet? And according to former Italian mafia man, today's multinational corporations have been modelling themselves quite successfully on the world's most ruthless and successful narco-cartels, the international mafia. Is he right? And never mind the human rights, EU companies are selling illegal surveillance software to human rights-abusing regimes where it's not illegal. Former Nazi company Siemens helping the Egyptian military ruler al-Sisi make sure nothing like the Arab Spring can ever happen in Egypt again. And in cybercrime world, it seems our very own GCHQ in Cheltenham was instrumental in making the virus designed to attack nuclear power plants, allowing reactors to run out of control. Is it time to close the Cheltenham donut down and expose these international cybercriminals? Also, as China suggests a Palestinian state headquartered in East Jerusalem, is Netanyahu determined to evict all the Arabs from the city? Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Martin, I think we better start with this story you pointed out to me about GCHQ in Cheltenham. Reading through it, pretty shocking that they were involved, intimately involved, in creating a computer virus that can let a power station, a nuclear power station, run out of control, and they were actually using it.
Yeah, the Stuxnet virus was created by the Western intelligence services, including GCHQ, as one of the, you know, the partnership, if we can call it that, that was involved. And it was designed to wreck nuclear power stations, specifically the Iranian nuclear power stations, although subsequently the virus transferred itself into the onto the internet, and then actually some people suggest played a role in the collapse in Fukushima some years later.
No, that was a tsunami.
Well, no, the tsunami, but the computer operating systems at Fukushima were not up to scratch because they'd been infected by Stuxnet. And I ask the listener to contemplate. Is it a sensible use of your taxes for GCHQ to create malicious viruses which are designed to destroy the infrastructure of foreign countries, to wit, in this case, the Iranian nuclear program? How sensible is that? Does that sound like a sensible use of your taxes? Because I would regard that. It's basically criminal under international law. And also, of course, creating viruses which wreck nuclear power stations. Can't people see what's wrong with that? Why there might be a problem with it?
From the wider question and Edward Snowden, this sort of fits in, I suppose, that the people at Signals Intelligence, other intelligence services, MI5, MI6, etc., people who do economic warfare as well, that they are using the cover of national security to actually do what is effectively international criminality.
Well, that's right. It's called national security, but it is in fact warfare by any other name. And, of course, if the Iranians, for example, in retaliation, were to write a similar computer virus and try and infect Hinkley Point, would we be happy with that? Or would the RAF be bombing them? Or maybe the Iranians should cut out the middleman and just bomb us, since we're trying to bomb them.
It all seems to have come a long way since the heady days of Bletchley Park during World War II, where the codebreakers were going through the Nazi codes and doing what they could to protect Allied forces in World War II. It almost seems as if they've turned into the problem themselves.
Well, as you're probably aware, Tony, the Nazi intelligence infrastructure was recruited lock, stock and barrel into NATO as it was created. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, eventually ends up heading the West German intelligence services. And in actual fact, these organisations are frankly not to be trusted. They're above the law, or they think they are, and they engage in activities which are A, unlawful, and B, extremely dangerous to the rest to humanity. They need to be deconstructed completely and reconstructed as democratically accountable organisations, and that is my considered view. We shouldn't just be stroking them on the back and saying how wonderful MI5, MI6 and GCHQ are. They are criminal organisations.
Well, it's not just us talking about this, and I was really disappointed that there's so little UK London media coverage. It makes London media look like some sort of propaganda outfit, right, the lot of them really, because this was in a documentary, the evidence for GCHQ's involvement in developing this Stuxnet virus was in a documentary, and I'll just read from The Register, which is a website that looks at sort of techie issues. The superworm known as Stuxnet, and this was on the 17th of February, and this came out, was but a cog in an active US war program which hundreds of thousands of networks, implants and backdoors in Iranian networks were actively maintained to facilitate a devastating barrage of hacking attacks. 0 days, this is screened at the Berlin Film Festival, claimed that Stuxnet was just one part of an operation called Olympic Games, that itself was part of a wider effort dubbed Nitro Zeus, that involves hundreds of US defense personnel. Fort Meade hackers worked furiously to mop up infected computers after a leak became apparent.
Well, this is the stupidity of this, is that once you've created destructive viruses to take down other people's infrastructure, those viruses can mutate in cyberspace and come back and hit your own infrastructure. In other words, they are as like amateur bomb makers trying to build IEDs in their back garden. And of course, if other states were doing that, it would be regarded as completely unacceptable. And the Americans continuously go on about how the Chinese are trying to take down their internet infrastructure and so forth. And in actual fact, all the evidence suggests that it is in fact the Western intelligence services which lead the pack in this particular nefarious activity.
Are we actually at war with Iran? I mean, because that's what it appears, if we're trying to take out their...
Well, sanctions on another country are effectively a war against them, because it means that, you're basically saying, we won't trade with you.
Oh, surely not. No, that's what they are, is a stage towards war, but it's not war itself.
No, sanctions are effectively a war. I mean, a blockade, for example, during a war is a sanction.
But its financial sanctions are not the same as a blockade.
Well, no, they are effectively
what it
hostile.
Does is it creates... It creates a market. For people to run the sanctions and get stuff.
Well, indeed, also. But I mean, we talked about sanctions on Israel last week, and of course, that's being made illegal for local authorities in Britain to bring in sanctions against Israel. Meanwhile, we're sanctioning Russia, sanctioning Syria, and sanctioning Iran. And the attempt to try and crash the Russian economy, which is the eighth biggest economy in the world, is absolutely bonkers. What if we succeeded and did crash the Russian economy? What do you think would happen on Wall Street and in the City of London if you did that? This is how stupid this stuff is, and we're on the brink of, and of course cyber warfare has now become an amazingly important thing. I mean, I understand, for example, that when the bombing campaign against Serbia took place in the 1990s, that they could have taken down the Serbian air defences with keystrokes, in other words, by cyber attack. But if they'd done that, then other people would have been able to work out how to do it, and they could have taken down the US and British defences with the same techniques. And of course, the only answer to that, if you're a military commander, is not to run stuff through the internet, but to have a completely separate set of a completely separate stuff that you run your own way. And of course, that's exactly what the Russians and the Chinese have been working on.
Well, I'll see if I can get a link to that Zero Days film. Certainly we'll make some references to it on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk. tonight, Zero Days at the Berlin Film Festival, but of course not on the BBC. European spy tech was told to sold to ultra secret branch of the Egyptian government, claims a new report this week. Protesters opposing Egyptian President Morsi have been waving flags in Tahrir Square about this. European companies are selling surveillance gear to the Egyptian government, known for its human rights abuses, Privacy International claimed in a report released this week. An investigation alleged that Nokia Siemens networks and hacking team had enabled the surveillance of Egyptian dissidents, prompting both calls for greater regulation of surveillance systems and denials of any wrongdoing from the companies in question. The Egyptian police are known for their repressive and brutal tactics, Martin, and this is just helping them along, isn't it? Giving them a nice little helping hand from Siemens.
Yes, and let's make this point that the Egyptian military government seized power, overthrowing a democratically elected government, whatever your views about them, about the Muslim Brotherhood. And in Syria, when the Muslim Brotherhood, because that's who it was, working with NATO, with the Turks, with the Saudis, decided to take up arms against the military government in Syria, as they saw it, although in fact Assad has actually won a democratic election, as has Sisi once he banned the Muslim Brotherhood on a 30% turnout. What if there is an armed uprising in Egypt, the same as the one in Syria? Are we going to send the SAS to train them? Are the RAF going to back up the rebels as they did in Libya? Of course they're not, because we're actually arming and training the other side. But what's source for the goose is source for the gander. If it's okay for the moderate rebels in Syria, as so-called by the Prime Minister, to take up arms against the government of Syria, then it's perfectly legitimate for similar people to take up arms against the government of Egypt, and of course against the government of Egypt's backers. Just as the Syrian rebels will be trying to kill Russian soldiers on the ground in Syria, so the Egyptian rebels might decide to come and kill the people at Siemens who provided the surveillance equipment. And that's a perfectly logical continuation of the policy. And if we're going to go down the road of revolutionary uprisings, then it's revolutionary uprisings all round. And as Hillary Clinton said about the death of Gaddafi, we saw he died. And that could be exactly the same for King Salman, exactly the same for Sisi, and exactly the same for their allies. Because if I was a democratic revolutionary in Egypt, I might conclude that Cameron was my enemy, and therefore he's a legitimate target in exactly the same way as Gaddafi. And if you're going to go down that road where there is no law, and it is just the strength of the powerful, that's where you're going to end up.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour about Siemens originally being a Nazi company, and reading Paul Manning's book, as I think you've done as well, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it makes it very clear there that what the Nazis were trying to create in the Third Reich was a common market. They actually call it that in the book. Siemens is a very powerful firm, isn't it? I mean, there used to be, for example, Plessy in Britain that made our traffic lights and various other things, that in the late 1980s, the Conservative government allowed a monopoly, a merger where Siemens took over Plessy's, and I just wonder what you make of the way they operate, because one of the things that Paul Manning makes very clear in that book is that they like to operate as cartels, and for example, if when the Nazis took over France, first thing that happened is Deutsche Bank started buying up large amounts of stock before the invasion in French banks, so that those French banks, which owned large areas of heavy industry in France, made it so that when the Nazi troops actually took over places like France and Holland, they pretty much owned most of the industry by that point.
Well, the interactions between the financial forces at the highest level are definitely the way the world is shaped. And what the Paul Manning book was making clear, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and also Operation JB book, which we've covered on this show many times. And I think it's generally historical knowledge for those who actually look into it, that the Nazi intelligence structure was integrated into NATO's intelligence operation from the get-go in the 1940s, which is why, of course, you got Operation Gladio, which was involved in killing civilians in order to create terror and mayhem so that certain political effects could be achieved. And those techniques of psychological warfare were honed by the Nazi and fascist intelligence operatives such as Klaus Barbie, who was eventually employed by the US to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. And the linkages between the genuine old-fashioned Nazis, the Gestapo, and the modern Western intelligence services, the MI6, the BND, and the CIA, is intimate. In actual fact, they recruited a lot of the top Nazi intelligence operatives, and that, I suggest to our dear listeners, explains an awful lot of where we've got, where we've ended up, because those kind of techniques of using terror, blackmail, assassination, and false flag attacks in order to achieve political goals, which were the stock in trade of the Nazi Party, have become the stock in trade of NATO's intelligence services in Syria and in Britain and elsewhere.
I would say also, reading Paul Manning's book, you know, that actually the industrial policy, the cartel structure of big groups like RG Farben, has also managed to find its way into the policymaking group, the European Round Table of Industrialists, which actually drafts much of the legislation for the EU. So I suppose we're getting into EU referendum debate territory here.
Well, we're getting into economic theory about cartels. Why do you have cartels? What are cartels? And cartels exist in everything. It's to do with the technology level that you're using. If we're all just selling apples that we've grown on our own orchards, there'll be thousands of potential suppliers.
To be fair, Martin,
and when you're talking about high tech, you can't have more than one or two high-tech suppliers of particular
goods. It's also to do with contract policy. And one of the things Manning explains is that when there's a competitive bid for a contract, the various members of the cartel, whoever wins, then shares out the production amongst the other members of the cartel. So it doesn't matter who wins.
Well, indeed. And in any case, what the main way in which modern capitalism functions is through so-called oligopoly. Ford don't have to exactly sit down with Volkswagen to decide what the price of cars is going to be. They just have to watch what their competitors are doing. And the idea that this is some kind of free market where the market clearing price is found through thousands of small producers, it just isn't the way the real world works. And ultimately, of course, we should have some kind of planning of this economy. If we're going to cartelise, then those cartels are not free market operatives. They need themselves to be kept under control by the public authorities, possibly to the extent of running things like, we're going to come on to this in a minute, things like arms production should not be in the private sector at all. No way, Jose. It's not competitive in any way, shape or form, partly for security reasons. That means that the most sensible way, if you're going to have an arms industry, the only way to have an arms industry is to have a publicly owned one. That's the cheapest and most effective way to have one. And I suspect that what we're going to talk about with these planes is going to bring that issue to the fore.
Also, Naked Security website this week, German police have been given the go-ahead to use a home-brewed spying Trojan, we're told. In a blast from the surveillance past, the German Interior Ministry approved a new version of the infamous surveillance malware that's been around for years and will be put into play as early as this week. The German-based Chaos Computer Club in 2011 was the first to spot the malware, which is called, among other things, the Bundestrojaner, the Federal Trojan, and which was developed by the German Federal Criminal Police. The CCC discovered that Bundestrojaner could set up a backdoor, remotely update itself, grab screenshots and activate the infected computer's camera and microphone. Now, this is all rolling out in the German police now.
Well, yes, I mean, and the thing is that the purpose of all of this is really to keep control of the general population. If you are a serious military organisation like the PKK, for example, you make damn sure that you don't use anything that can be infiltrated, and basically you don't use
Why be worried about this then?
Why be worried about it? Because it's about control of the population, and we're the general population. That's what they're into. That's why they want all this backdoors and Trojans and spying on everybody. It's not to catch terrorists. Terrorists don't function like that. Terrorists quite deliberately avoid using electronic equipment so that they don't leave any trace of their activities. So you're not going to catch terrorists by doing this, but you are going to be able to find out what the population are doing and blackmail the senior people in it and generally control the minds of the rest.
Now, we don't often do sport on this show, but tonight the FIFA presidential election has been taking place as the show's been going out, and Gianni Infantino is succeeding Sepp Blatter, Martin. But I was very glad to see that Sheikh Salman didn't win this, because there's human rights groups around the world have been condemning him for saying that he was should not yet be a candidate because he was... Although he was standing as to be the new head of FIFA, he's been accused of really serious human rights abuses in Bahrain.
Well, indeed, and also the Saudis are now head of the UN Human Rights Commission, I believe, with the support of the British and the Americans.
I mean, crackdown against pro-democracy athletes, for example, in 2011, Sheikh Salman was running this.
Well, incidentally, the Saudi army actually crossed the border into Bahrain, which is pretty much like the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, but nobody said anything about it.
So what's the relationship between the Saudi royal family and Bahrain, then?
Well, the Bahraini royal family, whose name I've forgotten, they are Sunni Muslims of a similar ilk to the Saudi royal family. But of course, the population of Bahrain is overwhelmingly Shia, as is the population of the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, just across the causeway, which is where the Saudi oil fields are. So you could imagine an independent Bahrain and an independent East Saudi Arabia Shia run, which would actually control the oil. But of course, that's not what's happening. You've got a military occupation by Saudi Arabia of Bahrain. And guess what? The British are going to build a naval base there. We are going to use our taxes to build a naval base in Bahrain, which the locals don't want. They've made it absolutely clear they don't want it, but the ruling group in Bahrain, the royal family, working with the Saudis, they are more than happy to have a British base there, which will be the same as having an American base there. Now, of course, what I would point out...
It's the House of Khalifa.
Khalifa, OK. But, I mean, the point I would point out about that, if Britain does go back to having a naval base in Bahrain, and don't forget, Bahrain only got independence from Britain in 1971, when we handed the country over to the Khalifa family... If any British personnel that are in Bahrain, better think on, because the Bahrainis might decide to take the Syrian option and say, hey, we've got British soldiers and seamen and Air Force people here. They are not here at our invitation. They're here at the invitation of the Khalifa family. Maybe what we've got to do is blow some of them up, just like in Syria, and make sure that they understand the price of repressing human rights. Because, as I was saying about Hillary Clinton saying earlier, you know, if you can kill Gaddafi, if he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, then certainly British squaddies who end up in Bahrain are definitely fair game, aren't they?
Well, certainly, talking about fair game, sport, both athletics and football, seems to have been drawn into the international net of competition at the biggest international levels between East and West, doesn't it? We've had the International Athletics Federation which Seb Coe, I believe, chairs. And now also FIFA has become very highly politicised. Sepp Blatter, certainly, I mean, you know, if you compare Sepp Blatter, he seems like a real pussycat compared to this guy from Bahrain who was standing. And yet we've been told that there's been terrible amounts of corruption at FIFA. It's all got to be moved out there. We've got to move to a wonderful new corruption-free international football.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of this has got to do with the attempt to make the Russians look bad. And so you've seen a similar thing in international athletics where the Russians have been accused of doping more than anybody else, which I think is a bit laughable.
Actually, even the German guy that made the documentary said that's not true.
Well, there you
go. The whole thing was based on.
Indeed, yeah. And of course, we're now going to have the next World Cup's going to be in Moscow, so that's the target of all of this. And then, of course, the next World Cup is going to be in Qatar. And the Qatari royal family, like the Bahraini royal family, they don't really have any proper support, although they are able to provide lots of weaponry to militant groups inside Syria who are killing, murdering, bombing, shooting, assassinating people. And maybe, you know, somebody needs to give the Qatari royal family a whack, a bit like Gaddafi, you know, bullet through the head, bayonet up the backside, that sort of thing.
Well, what about sport, though? Because sport can actually be almost like a sort of way of joining countries, can't it? They can be friendly through sport, whereas they might be shouting at each other in international diplomatic level. Sport can be a great healer, can't it? A bridge between countries. And well, it seems as if both in athletics and in football that the chance of that is receding.
Well, that's because they're being dragged into the geopolitical conflicts, aren't they? I mean, sport can't be separate from the rest of society. If there's a war going on, sport's going to be part of the war, isn't it?
Do you think it's part of preparation for war?
Sport, in principle, should be a means of trying to increase communication and so on. I mean, you know, if I think about the Springboks winning the first World Cup in South Africa after Nelson Mandela came to power, that was important in, you know, basically reconciling the white community to the changed regime and so on. And sport can, you know, I've got my interests in sport, particularly in rugby. You know, it's potentially something that's quite a healing and so on. And ultimately, of course, in the future, I would like to see all sort of contests between alpha males and others carried out on the sports field, not on the battlefield. But we're a long, long way away from that when we've turned the Middle East into a chaos and a mayhem, and millions have died and been displaced, and then everybody in this country wants to go in for a nice cup of tea. It's a bit late for that now. All those who said they wanted to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now all these people are turning up to say they want to come and they're turning up on your doorstep saying we want your help. Well, that's what was going to happen, wasn't it?
Do you think that the removal of the Russians from the International Athletics Federation over the doping and the removal of Sepp Blatter, who was largely seen as quite a even-handed guy, and the way that he's been demonised, actually, interestingly enough, by the United States, yep, who aren't really a footballing nation,
yep,
that this is a sort of perception management going on in sport at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Sepp Blatter, I mean, I'm not a great expert on this, but I think Sepp Blatter basically was a Swiss diplomat, effectively, and the deal was the Russians get the Moscow World Cup, and then the deal is that the Qataris get the follow-on World Cup because they were in competition to have it. So, in other words, he was an independent fixer, but no doubt taking bribes, as they all do. But he was independent, and as a Swiss, he was trying to make sure that everybody got a piece of the pie. And, of course, what the Americans have done is they're trying to make, as the Russians keep pointing out, they keep trying to push their own laws as if they were international laws, when they are not. So, for example, they insist that nobody is allowed to trade with Cuba, even though most countries haven't got sanctions on Cuba. The US has, and they try to force other countries to have sanctions on Cuba, even though they don't particularly want to have them. And I'm afraid this kind of argy-bargy is very much part of the geopolitical struggle that we're in. But, of course, it's a lot less unpleasant to have people removed from being head of FIFA and sent to retirement than having a bayonet up the backside and a bullet through the head like Gaddafi. But it's all part of the same game.
The Middle East always seems to be the centre of many of these international conflicts at the moment. Syria, quite clearly, and it has been, ever since I can remember, really, Syria, a bit of a flashpoint between East and West. But Prime Minister's questions this week, there was a question asked about Palestine by an MP who's literally just come back from visiting Palestine.
Imran Hussein.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Last week, I visited Palestine along with several of my honourable friends, where we visited the home of Nora and her family, who have lived in the old city of East Jerusalem since 1953. However, Israeli settlers are now trying to force Nora from her home of over 60 years. And there are many other cases. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that illegal settlements and constructions are a major roadblock that hinder peaceful negotiations? Absolutely. And what is this government doing to help prevent the infringement of into Palestinian lives and land?
Yeah. Let me say, I think the question the Honourable Gentleman raises is incredibly important. Look, I am well known as being a strong friend of Israel, but I have to say the first time I visited Jerusalem and had a proper tour around that wonderful city and saw what has happened with the effective encirclement of East Jerusalem, occupied East Jerusalem, it is genuinely shocking. And so what this government has consistently done and gone on doing is saying, yes, we are supporters of Israel, but we do not support illegal settlements, we do not support what is happening in East Jerusalem, and it's very important that this capital city is maintained in the way it was in the past.
Well, I'm glad to see David Cameron's talking some kind of sense about this, although I would point out that from the Palestinian point of view, they could take the line of the Syrian rebels, which is the time for talking is over. The time for bullets through the head and bayonets up the backside has come. That's what we say in Syria. Why don't we say that in Palestine? Because we want peace, do we? Well, we don't want peace in Syria, do we?
Well, interesting that the Russians have intervened. I mean, I know they've been interested in what's happening in the Middle East for a long, long time, but they're now saying this, almost like they're saying, well, look, this thus far and no further. We're not having the Israeli government move Arabs out of East Jerusalem. That's part of the original settlement, you know, back after the Second World War, and it's very important that Jerusalem remains at least partly an Arab city.
Well, they obviously the Russian position is that it should, and so is the British position. So Cameron, of course, is giving the traditional British position as coming from the Foreign Office.
So are you saying that maybe they're turning a blind eye to what's going on then?
Well, effectively, yes. I mean, if you don't put sanctions on Israel when they don't do what you want, and you're not prepared to go to war with them, although we are prepared to go to war with Syria and Russia, then you're basically saying you can do what you like. But I would argue that we've already gone over the line now. We have been arming and training Islamist rebels in Syria. Now, if we're going to do that, we might as well train and arm Islamist Islamist rebels in Palestine, in Egypt, in Bahrain. Let's get it over with. Let's get them all up against the wall, shoot them like they did with Gaddafi, and then there'll be democracy and freedom forevermore. Because we all know that war is the answer. It's the answer in Crimea, it's the answer in Syria, and that's what the British position is. That's where we're at.
You pointed out to me as well during the week, Martin, doing very good. We're doing very well this week. Hezbollah has got a Christian brigade fighting. Is it interesting how the way that you wouldn't necessarily expect that from Hezbollah, and we hear a lot from the sort of Christian Zionist point of view supporting Israel, but not so much supporting Hezbollah from the Christian point of view, there is a Christian brigade amongst the Lebanese fighters now.
That's right, because the situation in Lebanon is quite complex. You've got
isn't it a fairly westernised country? A lot of the government has been sold off, privatised.
Well,
sort of
yes, it's probably one of the more open societies in the Middle East, but it's a very, very mixed denominationally and so on. So you've got some.
ISIS are fighting in there too, aren't they?
ISIS are functioning there, helped and supported by the Saudis as they are elsewhere. And Hezbollah has an alliance with the Christian community against the extremist Wahhabis. And so it's not just an alliance. I mean, in the past, the Christians used to have their own militias, phalangist militias, who were quite right-wing, and in fact involved in the Sabra and Shatila massacres with the Israelis. But what's beginning to happen, and Hezbollah are a Shia organisation, but they're also a patriotic organisation, and they have gone to the Christian community and said, you know, if you want to fight alongside us against ISIS, we will allow you to form your own, we will train you, and we will put, you know, you don't have to change your religion to fight alongside us, we're all Lebanese, let's fight together and we will train you and arm you. And of course, that's the real world we're in, the world of warfare. And the British can't say that they don't want warfare. We support armed rebels in Syria. And if you're going to support armed rebels in Syria, armed rebels are armed rebels. We've got to support them in Kurdistan, for example, in Turkey. We've got to support them in Egypt and in Bahrain, obviously. Well, which means that British soldiers who go to Bahrain, as I said earlier, are going to be fair game, aren't they?
There was
in the warfare world in which we live.
There was talk about a truce in Syria this time last week, and there's now talk about a truce too. A week later, Syrian rebel factions say they will respect a two-week truce, according to The Guardian, just a few hours ago. CNN say Syria temporary truce is nearing, but fighting continues. What do you think? There's any real hope of a truce? And if so, is it going to be a complete truce right across Syria? Because certainly Assad and the Syrian Arab Army don't say they don't want a truce. They don't want to stop fighting ISIS.
No, but I mean, the agreement is that nobody's going to stop fighting ISIS. But of course, everybody knows that. I mean, the question is, who's supporting ISIS?
Well, the Turks certainly seem to. So they're part of NATO. Yeah. So is that a British position?
Well,
or not?
This what's beginning to happen is that the Russians are negotiating directly with the Americans to try and sort out some kind of agreed deal. Now, that's what should have happened years ago, but the West didn't want a deal at that stage because they were supporting the armed rebels, the al-Nusra Front, who are al-Qaeda Syria, and ISIS were definitely being supported by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Turks, and also, of course, the British special forces and intelligence people are on the ground in both Jordan and Turkey, along with their American counterparts, up to their eyeballs in all of this. And it may be that we've reached a point where everybody's going to back off, but I suspect not. This is a pause before we go over the cliff. We've been pursuing a policy of armed uprising in the Middle East for the last 5 years, and the time to say we don't want any more armed uprising because we've had enough now, it's too late for that. NATO, Turkey is a NATO member. We are part of NATO. Turkey supports ISIS. Turkey is trying to crush Kurdish democratic forces. We are implicated in all of that. And ultimately, we are at war. And we are going to lose because we're on the wrong side fighting for the wrong stuff. And we deserve to lose if that's the case.
Well, one of the big international conferences happened just a few weeks ago in Munich. We've got in July, of course, the big NATO annual conference, which I think is taking place in Warsaw in July. And this whole business of the conflict between Britain and Russia, or NATO and Russia, came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Michael Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Does my right honourable friend agree with me that with the NATO summit in Warsaw pending, with the threat of expansionism from Putin's Russia and the national security threat from Daesh, we are right in this party, this government, to support 2% of our GDP towards defence? And isn't he shocked at the failure of the party opposite to do likewise?
I think my honourable friend makes an important point, which is we do face an insecure and unstable world, particularly with what Putin has done in the Ukraine, particularly with what we see in Syria, and that's why I think 2% spending on defence and making sure we renew our nuclear deterrent is the right answer. To be fair to the Labour Party, they have got an answer. They're not going to spend 2%. They're not going to renew our Trident submarines, but they've come up with a really brilliant answer. They are bringing back, as their spokesman and spin doctor, Damien McBride. That is, 6 months after saying, and this is the leader of the opposition, we can win in 2020, but only if we spend the next 5 years building this movement and putting forward a vision for the new kind of politics, honest, kinder, and more caring. 6 months on, Damien McBride is back. That says it all.
Well, it's the usual knockabout nonsense at Prime Minister's Questions, isn't it? We could talk about Damien McBride, who cares? Let's talk about Russia and Syria.
He was special advisor to Brown.
He was. He's incidentally one of the sort of person that predicted that there was going to be a crash very shortly, and he's probably right. Now, all this stuff about Russian aggression in the Crimea and in Ukraine, as we've discussed many times on this show, the shootings in the Maidan Square 2 years ago were carried out by Pravi Sector working with Western NATO intelligence services. The shooting down the MH17 plane, it's becoming increasingly clear, was carried out by fighters from Kiev, probably with agreement with the British and
the
Americans.
When you say fighters, you mean...
I mean aircraft. in Syria, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister,
just before
is on
you,
the record.
Martin, can you just point us to some evidence for that? Where is the evidence that it was Kiev, Ukrainian fighter jets that shot it down?
I'm reading lots and lots of documentation about this all the time. Unless I've written it all down, I can't tell you exactly what I've been reading. But the point is that they haven't followed a normal procedure for an air crash. And all of the evidence, they've got satellite footage of everything that happened. The US definitely has satellite footage of everything that's happened. We've not seen any of it. And you know why? Because it doesn't fit the story. The Russians have shown what they've got and they've pointed the finger. Now, what we've got to understand is that the so-called Russian aggression is, in fact, aggression by NATO against Russia. The coup in Ukraine, because that's what it was carried out by Western intelligence services. And it was a very bloody coup in which a lot of people were killed, including supporters of the change of regime, who were killed in a false flag sniper attack.
Can I just point out one thing about the MH17 crash you mentioned there in Ukraine? There should be some pretty precise details about exactly what happened on that, and there has been an inquiry, but there hasn't been a full release, has there, of the equipment from the black box, for example?
No, the black boxes were handed over in good faith by the Russians to the inquiry, and then they were given to the British, and that's the last they heard of them. And that's because the black boxes probably show that the story put forward by NATO is a cock and bull story. Now let's come to Syria, which is even more important. Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, was on French television over 2 or 3 years ago, and he said that before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials, he presumably means MI6, who said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Now that is prima facie evidence that MI6, who are paid for from your taxes, dear listeners, were involved in creating the war in Syria, which has now killed hundreds of thousands of people and created millions of refugees. Now what should you do to the people at the head of MI6 and presumably in the cabinet who made the decision to make a war in Syria? What would we say to those people at Nuremberg? They were hung. That's what happened to the people at Nuremberg. Hung. Is that what should we do with these people?
You talked about refugees there, Martin. Now, this is one of the most horrific sides of all this. People who have got no choice. Some, of course, are economic migrants, but many have got no choice about fleeing for their lives with their families. Many in the hands of the mafia who are there to get them across the Mediterranean. But before they reach Greece, Italy, and countries like this, quite often these boats are themselves raided by pirates, effectively, apparently pirates anyway. But I spoke to Kevin Boylan on the Dialect programme earlier this week about these raids by the so-called German commandos, called German commandos because most of them seem to speak German, and also that they wear these balaclavas, look like commandos, and they raid these ships as they're going across, these poor defenceless people, take all their valuable possessions off them, and sometimes if they cause any problems, and even if they don't sometimes, then spill their fuel so that they're stranded in the middle of the Mediterranean with no means to get across to the north. So this is a horrific situation, but it looks, at least according to Kevin, as if this may be being sanctioned through the EU and by the EU, and that these may be in some way kind of almost like official pirates.
The evidence is overwhelming that this is a systematic and organised activity, politically sanctioned, if not also financially backed at a high level. It is certain that elements within the Greek police and Coast Guard are involved. And a number of these, up to 50%, according to Human Rights Watch researcher Eva Kosse, are fascists in Golden Dawn. Yet there are also consistent reports of other elements that either speak to the Greeks they work with in German or English. These may or may not be connected to Frontex, the European Border Police Agency, which certainly does work with the Greek Coast Guard and police. As we know, there have been recent attempts to militarize Europe's borders, and pronouncements to this end are being made regularly and with increasing frequency by European leaders in the media. NATO, too, has got involved. And a recent article in The Independent mentioned a NATO naval task force is being sent to the Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean to help intercept refugees in collaboration with the Greek and Turkish authorities. It is unclear what such a show of force is supposed to do, as the task force includes several destroyers and an aircraft carrier.
Well, it's probably to do with the deployment of the naval stuff is probably to do with the general tensions that are going on in the Eastern Mediterranean anyway, because there's a potential for this to become a major war.
But, I mean, people are obviously making a lot of money by pointing guns at refugees and stealing everything that they possess.
Well, don't forget that the Erdogan regime in Turkey was making loads of money out of supplying weaponry to ISIS and other groups and selling oil on their behalf. And, of course, also they then opened the refugee camps in Turkey, which they were perfectly happy to have at one stage because they were using them to recruit
until about
terrorists.
May last year, yeah.
Yeah, and then they pushed them in the direction of Western Europe in order to increase the pressure on the Western Europeans to support their attempt to overthrow Assad.
Do you think the failure to deal with the mafia in the Mediterranean, etc., is going to be the undoing of the EU?
Well, the failure to deal with the mafia are integrated into the governmental structures of Italy
and
the country.
They're also making quite a lot of money out of the refugee camps in Italy.
Well, indeed, there's money to be made. And, of course, the Erdogan family in Turkey are major profiteers on the arms smuggling to the terrorists inside Turkey, on the arms oil smuggling out of Turkey, much of which ends up in Israel, and of course on the people trafficking. There's money to be made everywhere for those who are war profiteers. Well, and war profiteers like war, don't they?
Well, Britain was involved, always seems to be involved in piracy. There's a lot of things, a lot of evidence now to link the Somali pirates to British mercenary groups that were several years ago. There's a lot of complaints about what are these pirates doing off of Somalia, that it may well have been linked to mercenary groups. And of course, Blackwater, who went out with their own navy to try and sort these people out, it may have just been a kind of game they were playing. But if you go back far enough to Captain Kidd in the Caribbean, he was actually working for the British Crown. It was only when he started to talk about the fact that he was actually working for the British Crown and he had the protection of the Royal Navy that he had his head chopped off. He was brought to the Tower and hanged.
Well, you mentioned the Royal Navy there. I sent you an interesting article this week. It was about a documentary about Sweden in the 1990s, and the Royal Navy were pretending to be Russian submarines coming into Swedish waters in order to make the Swedes more hostile towards Russia. It wasn't the Russians who were invading Swedish waters, it was the Royal Navy. And that then led up to the assassination of Olof Palme, the Social Democrat Prime Minister of Sweden, because the NATO bosses thought he was too soft on the Russians. He was just about to go and meet Gorbachev, he was assassinated. The Royal Navy were involved with the Swedish Navy in attempting to try and destabilise him before he was assassinated. Should the people at the top of the Royal Navy been doing that? Should they be put on trial, do you think, for being involved in doing stuff like that? Maybe they should. Maybe we should disband the whole lot and start again.
Anyway, there's a fantastic article this week on gizmodo.co.uk, which I'd not come across before, but it's a brilliant piece of writing, very well researched, and it's about this F-35B, Martin, which is going to be costing around about £20 billion of our money, which is supposed to be sitting on aircraft carriers and things like that, this new jet. Embarrassing technical stumbles, though. Engine fires, non-functioning cannon, a $500,000 helmet that fits comfortably in the cockpit on a pilot's head, but reportedly not in both, and also that there's a lot of impolite things that the pilots have been saying about this plane. They did a mock combat with an F-16 from the 1970s. The F-16 won hands down, so one wonders whether these things are actually going to be able to do what they're being told. Also, Martin, cracks in the wings, which means that many of the jets in the United States that the pilots now have been told that you can't turn corners too sharply, you've got to take a nice long way round the corner. But I mean, this is a Britain. Bristol's the centre for defence procurement here in Britain, with Abbey Wood up at Filton. What do you make of this? Whether, you know, how on earth something that looks like such a pig of a plane, some have called the scamjet, that we're prepared to spend so much, where even the American Defence Department are now reining back on their orders. They're saying, actually, this thing doesn't look like it's going to do the job. We don't want them.
Well, the fact is that because we've got a military-industrial complex in Britain and the United States, the more money we spend on useless equipment, the better, from the point of view of those supplying the equipment, as long as they get away with it. And eventually, of course, they don't get away with it. Well, the Russians, of course, have got a state-run military industry, and it'll be very interesting if it does come to a shooting war between the British, the French, the Americans and the Russians over Syria, whose equipment is going to stand up, because everybody's having a very good look at who's actually got the best equipment. The Russians, because they've got a publicly run
defence industry. Every ruble they spend on defence, they think very carefully about what they're going to spend their money on and what they're hoping to achieve by spending it. Whereas, of course, the more money that's spent on defence in Britain, the more salaries there are going to be for top executives at BAE Systems, whether the stuff's rubbish or not. Well, and that makes more of a difference, really.
Well, just from a couple of years ago, there was the example of the USS Donald Crook, wasn't there, which the Russians just took out, literally, like that.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that aircraft carriers are obsolete.
I mean, electronically.
Yes, yeah. They took it out electronically. Aircraft carriers are obsolete. What the Chinese and the Russians have been developing is cheap, effective missiles which knock out aircraft carriers. And if it comes to a fight, it may well be that the aircraft carriers that we, the two aircraft carriers that we've got and the many more that the Americans have got, will all be taken out in the first few hours of any conflict.
So how does it come that £20 billion of our money, George Osborne signs a little chitty to say we're going to be spending this on the F-35 without any kind of checks? And does he actually not know what he's doing?
Well, because the problem with any kind of procurement for the military is that for security reasons you can't really have a competition. We could probably buy cheaper and better stuff from the Chinese, but then they're the enemy. We could probably buy cheaper and better Russian stuff,
also,
but then they're potential enemies, so you can't buy that, can you?
This article uses a lot of quotes from a guy called Philip Sabin, and he's a professor of strategic studies at the War Studies Department of King's College in London, with a specialisation in air power. He's held research fellowships at Harvard University and the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He's now a consultant at the Ministry of Defence. I wonder how long for, because he's saying this thing is not going to work.
Well, that's right. Eventually, some people blow the whistle about this, about the SA-80 rifle, which was built by the private sector in the end and is basically regarded by serving soldiers as a piece of junk. And that's the problem with the military-industrial complex. They didn't lose the Vietnam War. America lost the Vietnam War, but the military-industrial complex didn't lose the Vietnam War. Every bullet fired, every bomb dropped is a cash register going ka-ching as far as they're concerned.
Last Saturday was the sentencing for the anti-tank missile, which was amongst the largest ever UK weapons cache found by police in Suffolk, Martin. Actually, enormous amount of weapons found by someone who was working for the local parish council. And this guy had loads and loads of unlicensed guns, a massive haul of weapons, not a Muslim or a jihadi in sight.
No, well, I don't know what was exactly happening in that particular context, but of course the Gladio networks...
463, basically it's enough to arm a very powerful battle group.
Yeah, well, the Gladio networks, which carried out all the terrorism in Western Europe from the 70s and the 80s onwards, they had all of these secret arms caches that they were using, which had been provided at taxpayer expense for them to use. The military-industrial complex is very expensive and well out of control and will drag us to war unless we stop them. But, of course, once they get to the war that they want, they may find that they don't like what they've got.
And in the meantime, let's go now to have a listen to Roberto Saviano, who's written this book called 000. He's suggesting very clearly that one of the models, or the most important model that multinational corporations and banksters in the West here are using, is the mafia model of the narco cartel. And here he is reading, this isn't actually him, someone reading from his new book, 000. 000 actually is the very best quality flour used in pasta, but it's also used in the cocaine trade, that term.
Kiki got drugs through everywhere with remarkable ease, and El Padrino's clan paid willingly. It seemed that Kiki could bribe everyone, could get everything across the border smoothly. It was because of this extraordinary trust, which Kiki had earned over time, that they began talking to him about something they never had mentioned to anyone: El Bufalo. After the umpteenth tractor trailer loaded with Colombian coke and Mexican grass made it over the American border, Kiki was taken to Chihuahua. He'd heard people mention El Bufalo 1,000 times, but he'd never understood what it was exactly. A code name? A special operation? A nickname? El Bufalo was not the boss of bosses or some sacred, venerable beast, even though it was usually spoken of with reverence. El Bufalo was one of the biggest marijuana plantations in the world. Over 1,300 acres of land and something like 10,000 peasants working it. Every protest movement in the world, from New York to Athens, from Rome to Los Angeles, was characterized by marijuana use. Parties without joints? Political demonstrations without joints? impossible. Weed, the symbol of a light buzz, of togetherness and feeling good, of sweet relaxation and friendship. For a long time, almost all the marijuana that Americans smoked, the grass consumed in universities in Paris and Rome, the weed toked at Swedish demonstrations and on German picket lines, was grown in El Bufalo. That's where it came from, before mafias delivered it around the world. They needed Kiki to get more trucks through, more trains full of El Bufalo gold. And Kiki agreed. On the morning of November 6, 1984, 450 Mexican soldiers invaded El Bufalo. Helicopters rained down soldiers who ripped up marijuana plants and seized what had already been harvested, entire bales ready for drying and chopping. Between what was sequestered and what was burned, $8 billion worth of weed went up in smoke. El Bufalo and all its plantings were under the control of Rafael Caro Quintero's clan, and it operated with the full protection of the police and army.
Well, it obviously went wrong for that operation. But Martin, seriously, this is a very, very powerful international force, the narco cartels. But it looks like the big banks are managing to model themselves on the way they've operated as basically criminal organisations.
Well, all organisations have an organisational imperative. The real problem is that the banks are basically funded by the drug cartels and the intelligence agencies, specifically the CIA, but not just them. Fund their various nefarious activities in places like Colombia through drug smuggling, as we found out during the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s when El Bufalo was functioning. We've basically got a criminalised elite. A criminalised elite that wants war but doesn't really understand the implications of having a war, because they think war is just about making money. And when you actually come up against real opposition, as they may well do in the Middle East in the next few weeks, we'll see how useless some of their very expensive equipment is and how badly thought out their geopolitical strategy actually boils down to being.
OK, thanks, Martin. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. That was an extract from 000 by Roberto Saviano. Up next, Mohammed Makawi's Arabian Nights, thanks to Martin Summers there, and also Paul Saville, mayor candidate, in the first hour. That we are online at thisweek.org.uk. That's the show page. I'm on Twitter as well, at Tony Gosling, and I'm wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us on the politics show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.